people were joining the Giving Pledge, including Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan. The campaign would grow from there, eventually going global and coming to include some 150 signatories. Fortune would call it the biggest fundraising drive in history. Big money looking for big impact. Although the Giving Pledge would become well known and was even featured on 60 Minutes, the actual mechanics of the campaign have received little attention. From the start, the idea was not just to get America's richest people to promise big bucks for charity. It was also to help these pledgers to give effectively. Olivia Leland became the first director of the Giving Pledge, working with a small staff to forge a community out of a far-flung group of billionaire philanthropists who, for the most part, didn't know one another. Leland would hold that position during the project's formative years, through 2014. She was succeeded by Rob Rosen. The effort to build community has had several components. Staff bring together pledgers in an annual conference, as well as in smaller sessions and conference calls at other times. Rosen told me that the Gates Foundation has aimed to find ways to connect pledgers through a shared learning environment so that they could be inspired and supported to find the particular areas where they wanted to be engaged and supporting mechanisms to help accelerate that and have greater impact. Given their wealth, pledgers are grappling with the challenge of giving on an outsized scale. But the basic questions they confront are shared by philanthropists at many levels. One question, said Rosen, is, to what? Donors often need help figuring out what causes or issues to contribute to. A second question is, how? Donors want to know how to choose a vehicle for giving, set a strategy, and measure results. A third area where pledgers need support, one that is fuzzier than the first two but still crucial, is how philanthropy fits in with the rest of their lives. All these issues get attention at the annual retreats, which usually take place in late spring and attract over half of the pledgers. The first retreat was held in 2010, the year the pledge launched, and there was uncertainty as to whether such conferences would make sense given how busy people were. The retreat took place at Miraval, a luxury resort in the desert outside Tucson, Arizona. Leland said it was a bit awkward at first, since most participants were strangers to one another, and yet some of the billionaires were well-known figures. That meeting showed that pledgers did, in fact, have a strong appetite for shared learning, especially among those newer to philanthropy. The retreats have been going strong ever since. These events take place over a day and a half that is jammed with presentations and discussions. The matter of where to give gets taken up in panels that dive into specific issues, looking at the ways philanthropic dollars can make a difference. One year, a top topic was supporting scientific research, an area that generated a lot of interest and led to a follow-up session after the retreat. Conversations about how to give are also a staple of the retreats, including at one session a staged debate for and against creating foundations that exist in perpetuity. Meanwhile, the bigger question of where philanthropy fits into people's lives always comes up. Giving away billions of dollars is no easy task, and some pledgers struggle with the work required to fulfill their commitment of giving so much to charity. Actually making sure the resources are deployed to have great impact is a challenge to figure out, and it takes significant time and effort, said Rosen. One thing to understand about the Giving Pledge is that even most of those who joined years ago have made little or no dent in disposing of their fortune. Despite all the attention the pledge has gotten, its full effects are unlikely to be felt for years to come. Much bigger giving than we've yet seen by these billionaires is required for them to meet their commitments. This gusher of new money will transform philanthropy in coming years. The U.S. billionaires who've signed the Giving Pledge have almost as much money as the combined assets of all the U.S. foundations that now exist, over 90,000 of them. The joint net worth of just Gates and Buffett alone is greater than the assets of the top 25 U.S. foundations, excluding Gates' own foundation. And while these two men have succeeded in orchestrating the giving pledge, both now have a lot more money than they did in 2010, as do most of the others who joined the pledge early on. Getting rid of that money will be no easy thing. Bill and Melinda Gates have said that they will give away all the money in their foundation within 20 years of when the last one dies, at which point the foundation will close its doors. Right now, that sum, along with their private investments, amounts to around $120 billion. But if you add in the money Buffett has pledged to the Gates Foundation, we're talking about an even higher figure, over $150 billion. At some point, moving money at this scale will likely require the world's biggest foundation to get even larger, increasing an annual grant-making level that already far exceeds that of any other funder by a large margin. As the giving pledge fully plays out, though, the Gates Foundation is unlikely to remain such a lonely giant. Oracle founder Larry Ellison was among the first batch of pledgers, revealing in his letter that years earlier he had already earmarked 95% of his wealth to go into a philanthropic trust when he dies. If the tech billionaire died tomorrow, the Lawrence Ellison Foundation could soon emerge as an entity on a par with the Gates Foundation. George Soros didn't sign the giving pledge, but has indicated that the Open Society Foundations will absorb the vast bulk of a fortune that currently stands at $26 billion, and that, given his investing record to date, could be much larger by the time Soros dies. Then there is the financier Carl Icahn, worth some $17 billion. In joining the giving pledge, Icahn wrote that he'd decided years earlier that substantially all of my assets would be used to fund a charitable foundation. When it one day comes into being, that foundation may be bigger than the Ford Foundation. Mike Bloomberg hasn't expressed much interest in leaving behind a large foundation, and instead has been on a tear to give while he's still alive. The problem is that he's not yet giving nearly enough. For all his big gifts in the past few years, he'll need to get money out the door at a much faster rate to ever fulfill his giving pledge. Bloomberg would need to give over $1 billion a year for 3 decades straight to do so. That is, assuming he doesn't get richer over time, as he has in the past. Zuckerberg, who may well get much richer in coming decades, faces an even more monumental challenge in disposing of his Facebook fortune. Gifts by living wealthy donors constitute less than a quarter of all annual charitable giving, which totaled $373 billion in 2015. The rest comes mainly from ordinary individuals, private foundations, and corporations, which is a reminder that there's a lot else happening in philanthropy beyond this book's focus on the ultra-rich. In particular, legacy foundations, including big national players like Ford and MacArthur, and funders who are locally focused, play a big role in shaping what's happening in the nonprofit sector, yet I don't cover their activities in this book. I should also stress that it's not yet clear whether the new wave of giving by wealthy donors will increase the overall level of charitable giving in the United States, which has remained stuck for decades at around 2% of GDP. What is clear is that this growing river of money will dramatically expand the size and influence of a new power elite of living donors that already wields enormous clout. One analysis by the scholar Kristen Goss found that nearly half of America's top 200 philanthropists, including many giving pledge members, have expressed an interest in shaping public policy. The pages ahead dive into the many ways they are already doing exactly that. Government down. In fall 2010, the same year the Giving Pledge launched, Republicans took control of both houses of Congress and a majority of state houses. The new majorities, brought to power by Tea Party activists and record campaign spending by wealthy donors, set out to enact sweeping cuts to government spending. The next several years in Washington would see recurrent budget battles and brinksmanship, including a shutdown of the federal government and a near default on the national debt. When the smoke had cleared, though, Congress had enacted long-term budget cuts totaling over $3 trillion. As a result, the funds that the federal government has available to try new things and solve problems, not to mention sustain basic services, are now forecast to shrink steadily through the foreseeable future. The axe has fallen in recent years across every area of discretionary spending, from scientific research to Head Start to environmental protection. In 2016, the share of the federal budget going to non-defense domestic discretionary spending, measured as a percentage of GDP, shrank to 3%. One analysis stated, "The share of national income going to these programs in education, science, infrastructure, environment, medical care for veterans, human services, homeland security, and other fields is rapidly approaching the lowest level, measured as a share of the economy, in at least 5 decades. The last time federal officials had so little discretionary money to work with, relative to the size of the nation's economy and population, Dwight Eisenhower was in the White House. But more cuts are predicted, and bigger ones too. Non-defense discretionary spending is projected to fall to 2.2% of GDP by 2024, a long slide from a high of over 5% in the 1970s, and the decline is likely to continue for decades. Quite apart from the legacy of the Tea Party, the public sector is facing intense fiscal pressure from two long-term trends. First, mandatory spending on seniors is set to explode as more and more boomers retire and start relying on Social Security and Medicare. Outlays for these and other entitlements is projected to nearly double in the next decade alone to more than $4 trillion annually. Second, interest payments on America's vast national debt will spike upward to $900 billion annually by 2026, nearly 4 times higher than current levels. By 2046, it's projected that, absent major reforms, mandatory spending will consume 21% of GDP, about the same level as all federal spending in 2016. Things won't be much better at the state level, where many employee pension systems have been woefully underfunded and now face long-term shortfalls of nearly $1 trillion, according to a 2015 study by the Pew Charitable Trusts. Top cities are also in the red, like New York, which had $46 billion in unfunded pension liabilities in 2014. States and localities have loads of other debt, too, thanks to the liberal use of bond measures over many years, and all told, now have $3.7 trillion in outstanding debt. Even if big reforms do happen, say a combination of tax hikes and spending cuts, the discretionary resources that government can deploy to tackle social or environmental problems are likely to keep falling for many years to come. In future decades, government is likely to spend much of its money cutting checks for seniors and bondholders. Meanwhile, philanthropic giving is projected to keep rising as far as the eye can see, at least in raw numbers. And if such giving also rises as a share of GDP beyond 2%, it could equal or surpass the percentage of national wealth going to federal, non-defense discretionary spending within the next few decades, which would be a striking milestone. Following World War II, government was always the richer, more powerful actor in partnerships with philanthropy, the sector that could take the ideas incubated with private funding and bring them to scale. In a future that's already arriving in some areas, as we'll see, it may be philanthropy that is often holding the fatter checkbook. A fiscal squeeze isn't the only problem facing government. Public institutions often aren't effective change agents because of lumbering bureaucracies and political dynamics that have grown ever more dysfunctional. While decades of conservative assaults have badly damaged public agencies, signs abound of a deeper calcification of government, which the journalist Jonathan Rauch has described as demosclerosis. In Rauch's telling, the public sector is no longer so good at innovation. The way for governments to learn what works in a changing world is to try various approaches and quickly abandon or adjust the failures, trial and error, Rauch writes. But that's become harder to do as myriad interest groups have become ever better at defending failed or unnecessary programs, from anachronistic farm subsidies to ineffective urban enterprise zones. In Washington, every program is quasi-permanent. Every mistake is written into a law that some vested interest will defend furiously. The result is that as the old clutter accumulates, government cannot adapt. Rauch wrote these words more than two decades ago. Things have only gotten worse since then. In the past few years, trust in government has sunk to new lows amid spectacular failures and fresh reminders of public sector impotence. Just look at the problems revealed in the Veterans Administration, or the bungled rollout of healthcare.gov, a linchpin of Obamacare. Or look at California's efforts to build a high-speed rail system, an obvious need for a sprawling state choking in traffic. Finding the money to cope with ever-ballooning costs has been only part of the challenge. Equally daunting for the state has been overcoming lawsuits and environmental challenges to the rail line. Jerry Brown, the state's Democratic governor, has run into similar obstacles in trying to get more affordable housing built. Any number of other big public plans around the country have also struggled in recent years. As Philip Howard has written in his book, The Rule of Nobody, this tends to happen because no official has authority to make decisions. Instead, he writes, government is run by millions of words of legal dictates, not by the leaders we elect or the officials who work for them. There remain plenty of bright spots in government, especially at the local level, where dynamic mayors are doing neat things. Overall, though, the public sector is not as inviting as it once was to people who aspire to make change. Plenty of Americans still want to heed JFK's famous call to give back to their country. But many of the most ambitious would rather be on the payroll of philanthropy than the public sector. One defense offered by today's mega donors for their activist giving is that they're helping America get around demosclerosis, whether by outflanking interest groups like the fossil fuel industry and teachers' unions, or by financing the risky experiments that elected officials won't touch. This can-do mentality helps explain why the givers have so many champions, even as a growing chorus of critics warn of creeping plutocracy. Ultimately, though, the power of the purse is the main factor that's moving philanthropists into the driver's seat of American life. It should be pretty obvious why shrinking public resources and dynamism translate into more power for private philanthropists. Because they're the people to whom social change makers and others will increasingly turn to finance new initiatives and existing services. Already, this dynamic is playing out in multiple arenas like education, science, environmental conservation, and healthcare. If you have a big idea for improving society, chances are you'll get further by hitting up a billionaire to back it than by lobbying elected leaders. In fact, increasingly, public officials themselves are turning to a private donor class to finance new projects. This shift is occurring against the backdrop of another long-standing and better-known trend, the growing dominance of the wealthy over politics, which has reduced the voice of ordinary people when it comes to who gets elected and what laws get passed. In his 2012 book, Affluence and Influence, Economic Inequality and Political Power in America, the scholar Martin Gillens compared the preferences of different income groups with actual policy outcomes in Washington, D.C., to confirm an obvious point, that the responsiveness of elected leaders is strongly tilted toward the most affluent citizens. Gillens found that the preferences of the vast majority of Americans appear to have essentially no impact on which policies the government does or doesn't adopt. In his 2008 study, Unequal Democracy, Larry Bartels found that low-income Americans were especially impotent, writing, "The preferences of people in the bottom third of the income distribution have no apparent impact on the behavior of their elected officials." Studies like this help explain why so many Americans have come to view U.S. society as rigged in favor of the rich. Because it is, and more people are catching on. One 2016 survey found that 65% of respondents agreed that the economic system in this country unfairly favors powerful interests. Other polls have found the same thing, showing that Americans have grown deeply worried that the upper class has too much power. Now, with the rise of big philanthropy, the wealthy are using an ever wider range of levers to turn their money into influence. Some say this isn't a problem because the givers back a diversity of views, including the voices of low-income groups and environmental activists who otherwise wouldn't be heard. There's much truth to this, as we'll see later in the book. But research has also documented that the rich diverge sharply from the general public in how they view key issues. That's especially true when it comes to economic policy. One survey, funded by the Russell Sage Foundation, found that the general public was much more likely than the wealthy to favor a higher minimum wage, expanded tax credits for low-income workers, and job creation efforts by government. The wealthy, for their part, are more prone to favor spending cuts to close budget deficits and to support free trade than is the general public. And they are far less likely to agree with a majority of Americans that the economic system is rigged in their favor. That 2016 survey mentioned earlier found that only 38% of respondents making over $100,000 a year thought the economic system was unfair, compared to 60% of middle-income people. Which makes sense. If the status quo is working just fine for you, you're less likely to question it. Meanwhile, on social issues like gay marriage and abortion, and also on the environment, the affluent tend to be more liberal than the general public. The rich really are different from the rest of us, and lately, philanthropy has become a more popular and powerful way for them to advance views that aren't necessarily shared by their fellow citizens. One other thing. Even as more wealthy donors charge into the nonprofit sector, ordinary Americans, struggling with stagnant incomes and rising costs, have reduced their own giving, according to some analyses. A 2016 study of tax data found that, since 2005, charitable giving deductions from lower-income donors have declined significantly and have been declining at almost the same rate that contributions from higher-income donors have increased. While itemized charitable deductions from donors making $100,000 or more increased by 40%, itemized charitable deductions from donors making less than $100,000 declined by 34%. Along with the rise of broader inequities in our new gilded age, civil society itself has become ever more dominated by the upper class. These trends are troubling in a nation that prides itself on its egalitarian values. Yet the details of how the new philanthropy is actually affecting people's lives and U.S. society are complex. In some cases, the wealthy are wielding this power in ways that further reinforce their dominance, financially, politically, and culturally, and you don't need to look very hard to find self-interested giving. In other cases, their money is going to empower marginalized people, amplify new voices in the public square, or make headway against problems that have stymied elected officials. Often, what's happening is a murky mix. Even when wealthy donors are expanding debates, true to the spirit of pluralism, we can't forget that it's they who are choosing which voices and ideas get extra juice. Cheerleaders for philanthropy see nearly everything the givers do as positive, while critics can be just as myopic and, at times, paranoid. The deeper I've dug into today's mega giving, the more I've come to feel whiplashed between hope and fear. This is a trend that is profoundly exciting and inspiring, but also very scary if you're worried about civic equality in the world's oldest democracy. Chapter 2. Who are these people? Maybe 20 years ago, there was still such a thing as a philanthropy establishment. It was centered in New York, with outposts in places like Chicago and Boston, and very much shaped by august institutions like the Ford and Rockefeller Foundations, along with the Carnegie Corporation. There weren't many big funders on the West Coast or in the Southwest, and only a few individual mega-donors who were active. Then, all hell broke loose. First came the rise of West Coast philanthropy in the late 1990s, when the emergence of several giant foundations rooted in tech wealth and bearing such names as Hewlett, Packard, and Gates. Next, a growing array of living mega-donors started to arrive on the scene, loaded with cash from boom times, not just in tech, but in finance, retail, media, real estate, and other areas. Many did things their own way, sometimes creating professional foundations, other times not. A massive gift from the publishing magnate Walter Annenberg in 1993 to improve public schools, and 4 years later, Ted Turner's $1 billion pledge to boost the United Nations, presaged a new era in which the super-rich deployed huge sums of money to achieve very specific goals, with ever more wasted along the way, as some said about Annenberg's record education gift, which left hardly a trace in its wake. In just the past decade, the world of philanthropy has grown even more crowded with newcomers, further splintering it and ensuring its lack of any cohesive, shared mindset. In turn, that fragmentation reflects what has happened with America's upper class as a whole. The stampeding wealth boom of recent decades, spread across many industries and regions, hasn't just vastly expanded the ranks of the rich. It's greatly diversified who these people are and how they think. The wealthy are still almost entirely white, yet otherwise they are an ever more varied bunch, and so are the biggest givers. Among today's top philanthropists are millennial techies, who don't remember a time before the internet, and octogenarian real estate barons, who grew up during the Great Depression and have never sent an email. There are donors who didn't go to college, and those with a raft of degrees. There are those who got rich in a few short years, and those who've spent many decades building their fortunes. Some givers were born on third base, while many others are tapping self-made wealth. Women have always played a huge role in philanthropy, but today that role is larger than ever, and an unprecedented number of women donors are giving away their own money or inherited wealth as opposed to their husbands. Today's philanthropists come in every political stripe, from far-right libertarian donors to progressive Democrats, with most somewhere in between. They are diverse in other ways, too. You'll find Christians and many Jews and mega-donors from all parts of the country, well beyond the new economy hotspots. Southwest oil money may sound like yesterday's news, but these fortunes are now bigger than ever before, powering a growing wave of giving that, among other things, is reshaping cities like Houston and Tulsa. In Chicago, old money and new money are working together to create a philanthropy boomtown. The North Woods of Maine have been roiled by controversy as one of the state's richest women has used her fortune to buy vast swaths of wilderness and push for a new national park. A top donor in Missouri has given millions to remake education and public policy in that state, while the heir to a chain of retail stores has used his grant-making to move North Carolina's politics sharply to the right. The biggest arts philanthropist in America has focused her giving not in New York or Los Angeles, but in Arkansas. In Colorado, which is now home to five billionaires with a combined net worth of nearly $40 billion, philanthropy is surging as never before. The same can be said about Washington State, which has twice as many billionaires today as it had a decade ago. And also more jockeying for influence among the super rich on such issues as education and guns. It's not so easy to generalize about all these people or their giving. There's an old saying that if you've seen one foundation, you've seen one foundation, which reflects how idiosyncratic philanthropy often is, and the diversity of causes and approaches that donors get behind. Lately, that's become all the more true. Why they give. The path that donors take to large-scale giving can be wildly different. William Ackman, who became a billionaire through hedge funds, told me that he decided to become a philanthropist in college, long before he had any money, after reading the social justice theorist John Rawls. Another hedge fund billionaire, John Arnold, told me that his philanthropic journey began at a checkout aisle of the supermarket when he saw a magazine touting the 50 best nonprofits in America. Arnold, who was making a lot of money and thinking about giving back, bought the magazine and made his first $25,000 donation to one of the groups on the list. Still another finance billionaire, Steve Cohen, was slowly drawn into ever larger giving over many years. He shrugged when I asked him about a $275 million pledge he'd recently made for veterans' mental health, his biggest ever. "It just seemed right," he said. His son, Robert, had served as a U.S. Marine in Afghanistan and had tipped Cohen off about the epidemic of suicides among returning soldiers. Herb Sandler, a retired banker, told me about growing up Jewish on New York's Lower East Side and instinctively siding with the underdogs of the world. Later, after making a fortune in banking, he would act on his social justice beliefs in a big way. Eli Broad, the billionaire benefactor in Los Angeles, described to me his urge to give back to a city that has been so good to him. Shelby White, another philanthropist who directed millions to her hometown, in her case Brooklyn, suggested something similar to me. Robert Shulman, who'd gotten rich from hedge funds, said that his turn to giving flowed from the simple fact that he and his wife Nancy had more wealth than they needed. "We realized we had enough money," he told me. "We had an apartment in the city and a big house in Westchester. I was not interested in private planes or private boats. Our children and our children's children were not going to want for an education or a retirement." Shulman said that for many driven business people, money is a way to keep score. At some point, though, the actual usefulness of having more declines sharply. The marginal utility of going from being worth $29 million to being worth $30 million is entirely different from the marginal utility of going from being worth $1 million to $2 million, he said. The marginal utility of going to $30 million is close to zero. It's not going to change anything. You can only eat at one good restaurant a night. As the money calculus changed, Shulman and his wife found themselves drawn more into philanthropy, eventually creating their own charity to help survivors of domestic violence and at-risk youths. When the giving pledge started, one smart move of the Gates team was to ask each pledger to submit a public letter declaring their intentions. Olivia Leland, in coordinating the pledge, was struck by how seriously joiners took these letters, often going through many drafts to get them exactly right. The result is a growing treasure trove of quite personal documents that offer insights into the motives of some of America's biggest philanthropists. Several themes run through the letters, starting with the sense of gratitude that Eli Broad mentioned. People who've done extraordinarily well are often very grateful to the institutions that have helped them along the way, as well as to the broader society in which they've thrived. Brian Chesky and Joe Gebbia, the founders of Airbnb, who met at the Rhode Island School of Design, each described how that school had opened up their sense of possibility. Both aimed to use some of their billions to ensure such experiences for others. I want to devote my resources to bring the moment of instantiation when someone who has an idea sees it become real to as many people as I can, wrote Gebbia. The hedge fund billionaire Glenn Dubin captured the sentiment of many pledgers in writing that philanthropy is my way of giving thanks to the opportunities I had had and my personal attempt to perpetuate the American dream. Priscilla Chan told me something similar, saying about her rise from an immigrant family to become a successful doctor, I would never have had access to all those opportunities were it not for all the people who supported me along the way. I wanted to give back. The idea that with wealth comes responsibility, as another pledger put it, is voiced often by top givers. One global study of high net worth individuals found that for nearly half who engage in philanthropy, a sense of responsibility is a top motive. Another theme in the pledge letters is a keen awareness among these billionaires of just how lucky they've been, and by contrast, how many people are unlucky. Warren Buffett has famously attributed much of his success to winning the ovarian lottery, that is, being born as a white male to middle-class parents in an America on the cusp of the post-war boom. George Kaiser, the son of Jewish refugees from Germany who had gone into the oil business in Oklahoma, said much the same thing. I suppose I arrived at my charitable commitment largely through guilt, he wrote. I recognized early on that my good fortune was not due to superior personal character or initiative so much as it was to dumb luck. I was blessed to be born in an advanced society with caring parents. As I looked around at those who did not have these advantages, it became clear to me that I had a moral obligation to direct my resources to help repair that inequity. Many pledgers point to their parents' generosity to explain their own commitment to giving. Sidney Kimmel, who made his fortune in apparel before moving into the entertainment industry, wrote, I learned as a young boy that sharing with others is the right thing to do, a lesson I observed from my father's willingness to share even our meager means with those less fortunate. Pete Peterson remembered his father, who owned a Greek diner, feeding countless numbers of hungry poor who came knocking on the back door of his restaurant. Lynn Schusterman wrote, I was raised in a household in which giving back was a core value. One of my fondest childhood memories is holding my father's hand as he visited less fortunate elderly people who had no one else to care for them. The study of the global wealthy mentioned earlier found that the most often cited reason for giving was personal fulfillment, and that point comes up a lot in pledged letters. Peterson wrote, As I watched and learned from my father's example, I noticed how much pleasure his giving to others gave him. Indeed, today, I get much more pleasure giving money to what I consider worthwhile causes than making the money in the first place. As I checked with the other philanthropists, I found this was a very common experience. Indeed, it is. Bill Ackman wrote, Over the years, the emotional and psychological returns I have earned from charitable giving have been enormous. The more I do for others, the happier I am. The happiness and optimism I have obtained from helping others are a big part of what keeps me sane. The psychological returns from philanthropy are well documented. It is a fact that givers are happier people than non-givers, wrote Arthur Brooks, an expert on giving who now leads the American Enterprise Institute. Brooks cited a range of research, including studies that have shown how giving affects one's brain chemistry, producing a helper's high. The positive mental returns from giving explain how initial modest philanthropy can snowball into something much bigger. Bill Gates has expressed deep satisfaction in a vast philanthropic enterprise that, to the outside, can look rather joyless and technocratic. It's the most fulfilling thing we've ever done, Bill Gates has said about his and Melinda's large-scale giving. Ed Scott, who made a fortune in Silicon Valley in the unsexy niche of middleware, told me about the immense pleasure he got from his first real gift. He made it through his church after his pastor spoke one Sunday about a congregant who was a low-income single mother. a waitress, she struggled to get around by bus and juggle the demands of caring for two children, one of whom was disabled, while working 8-hour shifts. Listening in the pews, Scott and his wife thought the solution to her woes was pretty obvious. She needed a car. So the Scotts anonymously donated money to buy her a minivan. They learned in a later sermon how it had transformed her life. "I saw things differently from that point forward," Scott said. Before then, Scott had been laser-focused on his business career. "My goal was one thing, make money. That's all I thought about. I was just like everybody else. I was interested in going to work, getting the stock options, and getting the big hit. If anyone had told me to care about something else, I would have said, 'Get out of my face, you're crazy.'" But after he sold a company he had helped start and scored a few other big hits, Scott was set for life, and then some. "I made more money, way more, than I ever thought I'd make in my wildest dreams." Scott had only a limited interest in spending that money on personal things. He told me, "I realized that unless you're a very greedy person, you can't actually spend more than $10 or $15 million on yourself." So starting with the minivan, he began to give away his extra money, and in larger and larger amounts, eventually becoming a leading donor to groups fighting global poverty and disease. Other top philanthropists have spoken of their giving with a mixture of obligation and practicality, namely that if you've somehow ended up with the means to try to solve big problems, you'd better get cracking. The eBay billionaire Pierre Omidyar and his wife Pam wrote in their pledge letter, "Our view is fairly simple. We have more money than our family will ever need. There's no need to hold on to it when it can be put to use today to help solve some of the world's most intractable problems." The Facebook co-founder Dustin Moskovitz wrote, "As a result of Facebook's success, I've earned financial capital beyond my wildest expectations. Today, I view that reward not as personal wealth, but as a tool with which I hope to bring even more benefit to the world." Paul Allen, the Microsoft co-founder, said much the same thing. "I believe that those fortunate to achieve great wealth should put it to work for the good of humanity." He added, "In recent years I have felt a growing sense of urgency about the mounting challenges confronting our planet. Through my giving, I seek to tackle climate change, prevent dangerous epidemics, save Earth's most iconic species from extinction, and restore our oceans to health before it's too late." Melinda Gates has said simply, "It's the right thing to invest back in society if we want to have an equitable and just world, and if you've been lucky enough to have some extra wealth and income." The sociologist Paul Shervish at Boston College has long explored how the wealthy think and why they give. He said that, whereas most of us accept that we can't much change the world around us, and so we live within existing institutions, the wealthy are far more likely to believe they actually can change the terms of society. "Great expectations and grand aspirations occupy people across the financial spectrum," Shervish writes. "What is different for wealth holders is that they can be more legitimately confident about actualizing their expectations and aspirations." Shervish describes this as a sense of hyperagency, which he calls the fundamental class trait of the rich, and a key to understanding these people and their philanthropy. That sense of hyperagency can certainly be found in the giving pledge letters, many of which are filled with proud details of the impact that pledgers have already had with their giving. "One of the most memorable moments in my life was at a charity dinner I was attending for a breast cancer cause," wrote Ronald O. Perlman, who'd made his billions through a sprawling conglomerate. "A woman approached me and said, 'I just wanted to say thank you. Because of you, my sister is alive.'" Perlman went on to describe the backstory, about how he'd met a cancer researcher, Dennis Slaman, who was doing groundbreaking work but was unable to find enough funding for a critical study. "The idea of funding this immediately appealed to me. I have always been interested in giving to projects that may not get done otherwise. I asked Dr. Slaman what he needed and then told him to get to work. The result of that research was Herceptin, a breakthrough drug for treating certain types of breast cancer. Other philanthropists tell similar stories about seeing a problem or opportunity and then taking action that makes a difference. Ed Scott recalled to me how he convinced an international aid group he worked with, Compassion Africa, to begin a more aggressive testing and treatment program for the HIV-infected children it worked with, many of whom were expected to die. He put up $750,000 as seed funding for the effort, which included hiring a top immunologist. Other donors eventually followed. Scott believes his intervention ultimately saved numerous lives. Few ordinary people will ever have such an experience, of knowing that other people are living because we did something to give them that chance. When giving has impact, the empowerment that comes from it tends to spur greater giving. Laura Arnold, who along with her husband John, a former hedge fund manager, has given away over $700 million since 2011, told me that the amazing thing about having a foundation is that you can move beyond grumbling privately about the problems you read about in the newspaper. "We love the fact that we're able to do something about it," Arnold said. "Instead of just being outraged, we try to channel that outrage into a solution that we think is constructive and a better alternative." Alexandra Cohen, who's also helping give away a multi-billion dollar hedge fund fortune, told me she had the best job in the world because she doesn't have to be an idle bystander to suffering or misfortune. She can take action and make a difference in someone else's life. Like so many philanthropists, Cohen learned to give from her parents, or more precisely, her working-class mother, who always had an eye out for needy neighbors in their impoverished Puerto Rican neighborhood in Manhattan. Cohen came to be the same way when she grew up, with a reflex to help solve people's problems. Yet now, thanks to her marriage to Steve Cohen, she has an almost fantastical ability to do so. That might entail giving $3,000 to a waitress down on her luck at her favorite IHOP, as Cohen once did, or giving $50 million to build a new pediatric emergency department at New York Presbyterian Hospital. The Cohens haven't signed the giving pledge, but are likely to give away much of their wealth, which now stands at $13 billion. That pile is three times greater than the Rockefeller Foundation's endowment. It will almost certainly grow larger still in coming years. Anyone with a bit of spare cash can read a story in the paper about, say, gun violence or melting ice caps, and then write a check to an outfit working for solutions. What's different about the rich is that they can give on a scale and with an impact that most people can't imagine. Chervish writes, "Those of us who are not wealthy pool our charitable gifts with those of others, and many of our gifts are anonymous. But wealth holders, instead of being simply participants in a charitable effort, can create new charitable organizations or operating foundations on their own. What takes a social movement for ordinary people to accomplish, wealth holders can do relatively single-handedly. They don't just find worthy charitable causes. They found them." That said, even the wealthiest donors, if they're smart, know there are acute limits to their power. You might imagine that those rarefied annual retreats that bring together giving pledge members as suffused with hubris. But Melinda Gates has described people's attitudes in those meetings as very humble. She explained, "If you're in the area of philanthropy, the problems are so large, and you know you're only a small piece of trying to figure this out." A final motive for big league giving worth flagging is that many wealthy people aren't keen to see much of their fortunes one day going to estate taxes, or maybe even worse, being passed down to their children. No billionaire has spoken out more strongly than Warren Buffett about the corrosive nature of inherited wealth. As early as 1986, Buffett told Fortune magazine that the ideal amount of inheritance to leave your kids was enough money so that they would feel they could do anything, but not so much that they could do nothing. That sum, he estimated at the time, was probably a few $100,000. Later, when Buffett pledged most of his wealth to the Gates Foundation, he said, "I'm not an enthusiast for dynastic wealth, particularly when 6 billion others have much poorer hands than we do in life." Bill and Melinda Gates read the Fortune article before they were married and agreed strongly with Buffett. Bill has written, "Melinda and I are strong believers that dynastic wealth is bad for both society and the children involved. We want our children to make their own way in the world. They'll have all sorts of advantages, but it will be up to them to create their lives and careers." Mike Bloomberg has been even more forceful on this point. "Inheriting too much money at one time destroys initiative, distorts reality, and breeds arrogance." Another billionaire, John W. Jordan II, echoed that sentiment in his giving pledge letter. "While I have taken care of my children and want them to enjoy comfortable lives, I do not believe that those who provide their offspring with luxuriously upholstered lives serve them well, but rather saddle them with a terrible burden. The trappings of extreme wealth are quite dangerous, if not intelligently and responsibly directed. We all know second and third generation wealth where the recipients were actually born on third base, but think and act like they hit a triple." The core motives that the rich have for giving help explain the why of their philanthropy, but the context of their lives play a huge role in explaining the how of that giving. The sociologist Francie Ostrower spent years in the 1990s looking into this area, first as a graduate student and later as a professor at Harvard. "Elite philanthropists," she wrote in her book, Why the Wealthy Give, "live in a milieu in which giving is the norm and characterize philanthropy as an obligation that is part of their privileged position." Ostrower detailed the many ways that the wealthy are pulled into giving through a web of organizational and social ties. An attention to status is definitely part of the equation. Philanthropy functions as a mark of class status that is connected to elite identity, Ostrower writes. How giving plays out, though, in terms of what donors support, depends on the affiliations they have. For example, Jewish donors have their own strong networks, with set norms and favored causes. Shervish makes similar points. "Donors are often spurred by a sense of identification with others," he writes, "starting with people most like themselves, which is why so much charity tends to flow to institutions that donors have a direct connection with, particularly religious institutions, arts organizations, and schools. But identification can also take the form of empathy for the less fortunate, especially for donors who've struggled at points in their life." One way to get a handle on the newer philanthropists and how they wield influence is to look at how they got rich in the first place. When the wealthy get into giving, they tend to turn to friends for guidance, who are often peers in their industry. They may kick in for the same causes, use the same philanthropic advisors, and embrace the same approaches as others around them. If you want to better understand today's new donors, a good place to begin is with the philanthropic tribes they belong to. Tech philanthropists. No industry is producing more big new donors these days than tech, which has spawned enormous fortunes in an era of rapid digital breakthroughs and expanding global markets. Who are these people, and how do they think about philanthropy? The first thing to understand is that there have been two waves of tech philanthropy. The first was in the 1990s, when some of the top fortunes of the early computer boom were harnessed for giving. Bill Hewlett and David Packard both endowed massive foundations, and in 2000, another industry pioneer, Intel's Gordon Moore, gave $5 billion to create a foundation. That same year, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation was launched, seeded with a $27 billion gift from the couple. Gates's early partner in founding Microsoft, Paul Allen, had started a foundation in 1988, but stepped things up as the new century began with big giving for brain research. Pierre Omidyar and Jeff Skoll of eBay were two other tech winners who turned to large-scale philanthropy during this period, as did Quark founder Tim Gill and GeoCities founder David Bonnette, both with a focus on LGBT rights. Steve Case, the co-founder of AOL, started his foundation in 1997 with his wife Jean. Michael Dell, the PC computer billionaire, also worked closely with his wife Susan to create a foundation that got going in 1999. Another tech titan turned philanthropist from that go-go era is John Mordridge, who built Cisco Systems into a giant in the 1990s and then sank the bulk of his winnings into a foundation he ran with his wife, Tasha. The couple who had founded Cisco, Sandy Lerner and Leonard Bozak, made far less money than Mordridge did and ended up giving most of it away. Irwin Jacobs, the billionaire who founded Qualcomm in the 1980s, also went on to become a major philanthropist. A range of other early tech winners also became donors, like Mitch Kapor, the founder of Lotus. The second wave of tech philanthropy has unfolded since about 2010. That was the year Mark Zuckerberg made his $100 million pledge to improve Newark's schools. Two other Facebook billionaires soon joined Zuckerberg in large-scale giving. Sean Parker, who set up a major new foundation in 2015 and has emerged as a large-scale donor to medical research, and Dustin Moskovitz, who is moving growing sums of money through the foundation he set up with his wife, Carrie Tuna. The couple plan to give away all their wealth while they're still alive. Facebook riches have also been channeled to philanthropy through Jan Koum, who put aside $600 million in a donor-advised fund after scoring a huge windfall from the sale of WhatsApp to Facebook in 2014. That same year, Oculus co-founder Brendan Erieb gave $31 million to the University of Maryland, which he had dropped out of, after selling Oculus to Facebook. Jim Swartz, whose firm Accel was one of the earliest investors in Facebook, is now deeply engaged in philanthropy with his wife, Kathy. Meanwhile, the billionaire founder of Salesforce, Mark Benioff, has lately emerged as a leader of the tech philanthropic community in the Bay Area, working with his wife, Lynn, to make huge gifts for hospitals and seeking to rally other donors to give more in the region. Benioff is also pushing tech startups nationwide to set aside a chunk of their firm's equity for philanthropy, as he did when founding Salesforce. Both the Google co-founders, Sergey Brin and Larry Page, who together have a net worth of more than $75 billion, have started setting aside sizable chunks of wealth for philanthropy. Brin parted with $850 million between 2011 and 2014, funds that helped build up a large foundation and support a wide array of causes. Page, who gave away $177 million in 2014 alone, including $15 million in emergency funds to combat Ebola, has also been quietly building up a major foundation, which is named after his father. It now has well over $1 billion in assets. Eric Schmidt is a third Google billionaire plowing big bucks into philanthropy, working with his wife Wendy to sound the alarm on environmental threats, among other interests. Any number of other tech people are also giving at varying levels, such as Twitter co-founders Evan Williams and Jack Dorsey, PayPal co-founder Peter Thiel, the venture capitalist Mark Andreessen, the angel investor Ron Conway, LinkedIn founder Reid Hoffman, and Tesla's Elon Musk, whose giving interests include taming the existential threat posed by artificial intelligence. Beyond these big names, plenty of other tech winners have lately been turning to philanthropy, such as Mike Krieger, who started Instagram. Along with his wife Caitlin, Krieger is putting money behind criminal justice reform, among other issues. The couple has been helped along in this work by the philanthropic operation piloted by Carrie Tuna and Dustin Moskovitz. Quite a few of today's younger tech donors are in touch with one another and, increasingly, have a shared outlook on philanthropy. For starters, most believe in starting to give early. People wait until late in their career to give back, but why wait when there's so much to be done? Zuckerberg said after he joined the Giving Pledge in December 2010. With a generation of younger folks who have thrived on the success of their companies, there is a big opportunity for many of us to give back earlier in our lifetime and see the impact of our philanthropic efforts. Zuckerberg made his first big